General Jordan Collette, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that name, versus Robert Keeling et al., Ms. Banks and Ms. Mundy.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Sequita Banks, and I represent Mr. Orel Jordan Chalet.
Would you like to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
All right, that'll be fine.
The Supreme Court in the United States has held in several cases that the rights to conceive and raise one's child is deemed to be essential.
Let me stop you because I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Okay.
You have to establish that you're a parent of a child. And the courts here, both the juvenile court and the circuit court, concluded your client didn't have standing. So we need to get past that before we can get to the merits of anything else, it seems to me. Because if you're not provably a parent, none of those constitutional rights you're about to allude to exist, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, my client, as soon as he found out that the baby was born, had filed petitions in the juvenile courts in May for petitions for paternity, custody, visitation, child support.
Those are assertions. Where's the conclusion? And where in the appendix can we see that it establishes that he's the father?
Well, the only thing that's in the record that establishes that he's the father establishes that he's the putative father. And the key point is that my client tried to establish his parental capacity as the actual father of the child, was prevented from doing so because by the time he had found out that his petitions were thrown out of the juvenile courts because his parental rights had already been terminated a month prior by the JDNR courts. And then we have to go back and look at the notice issue because it is the due process violations that occurred from the outset of this case.
Let me start again, counsel, because we have basically, if not two hands tied behind our backs here, we have at least one and a half, it seems to be, tied behind our backs, because we don't have a record to speak of. We have a lot of statements made in the briefs, but we don't have a record. Now, there are all kinds of probably reasons why we don't have a record, but that's the fact that we're confronted with. Now, it seems to me that in a situation like this, the proper thing to do is to file a suit to establish paternity. We don't know if that was ever done or not. We do know there was a motion to intervene that was denied for lack of standing, and that's really all that's before us. So, I mean, in terms of getting from point A to point B, you really need to help us figure out how to get there when we have no evidence in the record at all to support paternity here.
I'll be glad to do so, Your Honor. I mean, again, to restate it, though, I do believe that it all comes down to the fact that we are now initially on our request for the appeal of our denial to intervene in the adoption proceeding, because we were not able to take any action in the adoption proceeding at all to request paternity, to file anything, until we were made a party to the suit. And that's why we filed our request to intervene.
Could you have filed an independent action to determine paternity?
We tried to file an independent action, but because the adoption file was sealed completely, we were not able to attach that to the adoption proceeding, because initially I had just filed a request to access the court records just so that we could try to establish what happened here with the notice, and that was denied and appealed and then subsequently denied.
Well, I mean, clearly if the record's been sealed, then unless you can prove you're an interested party, you have no authority to access the record.
Right.
So it's not for me to tell you how to practice law, but it seems to me the way to accomplish that end is exactly what Judge Russell just alluded to, which is you file a separate suit asserting paternity and join the mother and any other interested parties that may be involved and go from there.
The problem is that by the time my client had already done that, his petitions were thrown out by the juvenile courts because the termination of parental rights proceedings had already taken place a month prior. So he had tried to do that, and because he was given notice...
But again, we don't know that, except that you're telling us that. And you're, unfortunately, what you say isn't evidence. I mean, you're an officer of the court. I have no reason to disbelieve anything you've told me, but we can't
right.
rely on that, you know, from the standpoint of the record.
I understand, but the record does have the orders from the lower court in there that states that he was the putative father and that he was given notice and that the notice was proper, and therefore they went ahead and terminated his parental rights. That is in the record.
Well,
and because of that order...
Can you give me a joint appendix site for that?
I can. I believe it's actually going to be... either it was attached as an addendum and for the motion to reconsideration, there was one attached there, which would
can
be...
Can you give us the page number of the joint appendix so we
yes,
can find it?
Yes, that's what I'm looking for right now. Court's indulgence.
If you refer to the motion for reconsideration, that appears on page
19. Page number... Yes.
It begins on page 19, I should say.
Right, page 19. And as an attachment to that, you'll see a statute and also the order accepting consent to adoption, appointing the custodians of a major, minor child, in which it states in the order that my client consent was not required because he was not considered to be in the class to give consideration to give consent. And then if you also look in the reply brief,
I assume you're referring to numbered paragraph 11 on page 27, which states the putative father of the child is identified as Jordan Collette.
Yes.
That the birth mother swore in her consent to adoption affidavit of paternity that this putative father was aware of her pregnancy and that she met with him on January 25, 2014, at which time he provided her with his address of 642 South Clark Street, apartment 711, Chicago, Illinois. Is that what you're referring to?
Right. And then also that we have a separate order.
I don't know that that's a finding that he's the putative father. It simply acknowledges that he is asserting it, that he is the putative father.
And then if you would be so kind as to look at the reply brief and the addendum that or the order that's attached to the reply brief, it gives a better explanation of the fact that he is, in fact, the putative father, and it goes into the notice and how the notice was sent to him to inform him of his right to register.
All right, let me find the addendum
okay.
here. I'm looking at your reply brief. All right. I'm sorry. Where in the order now are you referring to?
I'm referring to where it states that he's, in fact, it would be the second page of that, that he was determined to be the putative father and that notice was sent to him and that there was a registration form that included his name.
Well,
that's the part of the order that says he didn't file timely, correct?
Right, which is another issue that I'd like to address before the court because there needs to be a review of how that was done. But in either case, we have that order and some other orders applied by the appellees.
Okay, you're getting ahead of me here. I'm still trying to catch up with you. I'm looking at the order you just alluded to. It certainly acknowledges that that the department received a registration bearing the name Oral Collette, and I assume that's referring to the putative father registry registration, and that the form was more than 40 days after the mailing the notice and more than 30 days after the statutory deadline. And then, but nowhere in here do I see any sort of finding by the court of paternity of your client.
See, the problem is, Your Honor, there is not going to be an actual order that we have that establishes paternity of my client as being the father because he was prevented from being able to establish that even by filing.
And that could be an issue on appeal if that had been
appealed
and preserved and all that. We had a record supporting all of that, but But again, we can't, unless you're the father, you have no standing to.
Right.
And I'm not saying he's not. I mean,
right.
I just, but we, you know, this statute is a very strict statute.
Understandably so, Your Honor. And the problem is that when they determined that my client, parental rights were terminated, he did not have any notice to that hearing to be able to even appeal from that. He lost standing. He lost everything from that one order.
All of that is great if there's a record that supports all of that. So, in other words, the threshold question is, has there ever been a hearing that is before us? Has there ever been a court proceeding before us where all these things you're asserting were presented to the court and improperly rejected to the point where your client's rights were denied, in which case we'd have something we could sink our teeth into at this level. But without that, basically you're suggesting that we decide this case on the pleadings rather than on the record, and we can't do that.
And unfortunately, Your Honor, the only reason why I say that is because we were stopped at every point in the circuit court from intervening in this case, from trying to file anything to get us to get on the record, to get what we needed in order to have the case properly before, a record properly
and
before.
And hypothetically,
you.
The way, frankly, I think it probably should have been handled is when a court, for example, hypothetically had the juvenile court said, I'm sorry, I don't want to hear you. There should have been a court reporter taking all this down, and there should have been objection. Your Honor, excuse me, we have a right to establish paternity, cite the cases you refer to relating to the Constitution or whatever, the statute, anything you want to, and then that becomes the record, and you can make that point on appeal to us, but we don't even have that.
Unfortunately, my client was not represented by an attorney at that point in the proceedings. However, I do believe that the pleadings before the court do establish that there are problems with notice, and we have to look at those issues with notice.
But we can't rely on the pleadings for anything except accusations. I mean, you know, we have to.
But they're orders, though. They're not only just pleadings, but they're actual orders.
But there's nothing to suggest there's anything wrong with them except the pleadings.
Right, but in the corresponding orders, and if you look at the corresponding orders, you will see that there was a problem with the notice of the adoption plan and the existence of the registry was sent to my client, was subsequently returned because it was addressed improperly. There was no zip code on the envelope. It was returned back to Birth Mother's Council. So there's clear, and it's right there in the order, that he never
and
received
all of,
the
all of those points may well be well taken if he's the father. But we don't have anything before us other than an assertion that he's the father. That's the fundamental hurdle we have to get over here.
Right, but even if the court can't determine at this stage if he's the father, we can at least determine if his rights were violated.
But he doesn't have any rights if he's not the father. They're all, those constitutional rights all derive from the fact of his paternity.
But he was determined to be the putative father, and the putative father is entitled to certain rights, certain due process rights that were not afforded in this case. And had they been afforded, we wouldn't be having this difficulty today with trying to argue to establish why he didn't appeal the paternity issue.
Well, I got to tell you, just personally, this is a sad situation because there aren't many fathers that'll step up and offer to you know, basically man up and do the right thing and support their children. And so, you know, I applaud your client's desire to do that. I'm just observing that we have a lot of fundamental procedural issues that stand in the way here, and we may or may not be able to get to where you want us to go, no matter how desirable that might be.
Ms. Banks, was the juvenile court's denial of the petition to establish paternity, was that appealed to the circuit court?
It was appealed to the circuit court, but we were not able to successfully proceed with the appeal because all of the documents that we needed came from the sealed adoption file. So every time we try to do something, it's always you're kicked out because everything we need comes from the other file, which we can't get access to.
Did the petition to establish paternity come after the adoption was final?
After his parental rights had been terminated. And I don't understand.
Before, after the adoption was final?
It was before the adoption was final, but after his parental rights had been terminated. And the one question I have before the court is, if the court has the authority, the lower courts have the authority to terminate his parental rights without establishing whether he was the father or not, then how can it be that we can't now come back and say they terminated his parental rights without adjudicating that he was the father or not? So why can't we now come back and argue that since he never had that opportunity because he was foreclosed from doing so because they prevented him from even pursuing his paternity petitions, why can't he be given that same opportunity? I mean, it was an egregious violation of due process rights from the outset of this case.
All right. Thank you, Counsel. We made you use up all your time. I'm going to give you 2 minutes in rebuttal anyway, okay? Ms. Monday. Afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Monica Monday, and I'm joined at counsel table with Stan Phillips, who is trial counsel in this case. This appeal is from an action titled A Request for Leave to Intervene. The only finding made by the trial court was a denial of the motion for leave to intervene on grounds that the appellant did not have standing. In light of what occurred below, there are really only two issues before this court. One, is the appeal moot because the entire adoption proceeding has been adjudicated to conclusion? And second, did the trial court abuse its discretion in finding that the appellant did not have standing?
Well, Ms. Money, let me stop you on that point. Hypothetically, assuming we were able to deal with the issue, if due process arguably had been violated, in other words, you know, Troxell versus Granville certainly stands for the proposition that there's constitutional implications to terminating parental rights of parents. Just in the abstract, you've got to deal with some certain liberty interests there. And where you haven't given notice and you have a procedural due process issue, it seems to me, at least arguably, that notwithstanding the draconian nature of the statute and expressing the intent of the General Assembly that these orders not be disturbed, if you have a fundamental defect at the very beginning of constitutional proportion, that mootness argument you're making may not carry a whole lot of water, assuming, and it's a big if, but assuming there are all these other, you know, we had the record, he was the father, he'd never received notice, there was some fraud in the notification procedure, anything along those lines, it seems to me your mootness argument wouldn't be as strong as you're asserting that it is now.
Conceivably it could, Your Honor, if there was a record to support those particular claims, and there's not. But also, let me correct the record here. He is a putative father. At best, he has not been adjudicated to be a father, he's not been an acknowledged father, and he's not a presumed father, as all of those terms are defined by the adoption statute. As a putative father, he was entitled to the notice that he was given under 63.2-1250E, which is either personal service or a mailing of a certified letter. But let's even assume the best scenario here. This court, the Virginia Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court have recognized a difference between a mere biological link to a child and an already established relationship with a child. And so, for example, in dealing with 63.2-1216, the six-month window that the legislature has permitted for challenges to final orders, this court held in FE versus GFM, and as well in the McCallum versus Salazone case, that there must be a threshold finding to get beyond that 6 months that there was already an established relationship with the child. So to argue that he has the due process rights that Ms. Banks has argued is incorrect,
Ms.
so we dispute that.
Money, to go back to the hypothetical, I want you to assume that he is the father, okay?
Biological father. Is that?
That's how I mean the term.
Okay.
He is, in fact, the father, and that he was never provided the notice, and he was provided the notice because the letter was intentionally misaddressed. Okay. If you, I'm not saying the record supports all that, but I'm just asking, if you assume all of that, don't we have a constitutional problem with enforcing 63-2-12-16 in such a way as to say, even though you were entitled to be notified, even though you have rights as the biological father, all of those things, you still can't appeal it? I mean, it seems to me that there's no way that that can be the answer.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I have two answers.
One, I recognize that it's a hypothetical.
Sure, agreed. I mean, first of all, he can't meet the threshold finding of getting past the six-month window because of what I've already talked about. He doesn't have an already established relationship. And the way you get past the six-month window is through extrinsic fraud. Second, that's not a matter that this court can adjudicate either in the forum in which it's in, which is on an appeal from a motion to intervene, and not anything else. It would have to be addressed in a separate proceeding where the proper parties were joined, where there was an adequate record to address it, and the court ought not to engage in those that type of inquiry here. And in fact, it cannot. It doesn't have the record. It doesn't have the parties. In the juvenile court, there were hearings. There were affidavits submitted. There was testimony taken. The actual envelope itself was before the court, and I've not seen it, but my understanding is it is part of that court record. It is really another court in a separate proceeding that is going to have to adjudicate that matter if the appellant can meet the threshold finding that he had an established relationship with the child. But it's not, this court can't reach it. There's no relief that this court can order today for the appellant because, number one, the adoption proceeding is concluded. Second, the trial court was absolutely right that the father lacked standing. He had already been, as I believe Ms. Banks has acknowledged, his parental rights had been terminated.
If the order terminating the parental rights was void ab initio, does that change the analysis at all?
It does not for this court, Your Honor. It may change the analysis if the appellant can meet certain requirements and prove a case in another court. But this appeal is merely from a denial of a motion to intervene. This court has said in the Mattapani Indian Tribe case, as well as in the Tidewater Psychiatric Institute case, that when a case comes to this court in this posture, from the denial of a motion to intervene, as was the case in the Tidewater Psychiatric case, the party is only aggrieved of that ruling. There was no trial court finding about due process, about notice, about compliance with the statute. There's nothing for this court to review, nor is there a record by which this court could do it if it wanted to. So the narrow issue before this court is, was the trial court correct that the father did not have standing? And I believe that appellant's counsel has conceded today that because of the entry of both the JNDR court order at the end of April, accepting the mother's consent, as well as the interlocutory order just a few weeks later, which terminated the father's rights, that as of that time, even before the instant action was filed, he had lost his parental rights.
Does the trial court's reliance on the fact that his parental rights had been terminated necessarily accept some factual predicates that put that in front of us? I mean, obviously he had to have been given notice under the statute or his parental rights can't be terminated, correct?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. It's interesting when you look at 63.2-1250E, where the whereabouts or the identity of the putative father are reasonably known, all that it requires is a certified mailing. The statute doesn't even require that he get it. And in fact, the statute says that any man who has sexual intercourse with a woman is on legal notice that a child could be conceived. That's the way the statute has been set up. Now, the trial court's only findings were, I'm going to follow the orders that have already been entered. And that's exactly what the trial court should have done. It followed the orders that were entered. And those orders are, as of we stand here today, are still valid orders of the juvenile court and of the circuit court. And those orders not only terminated the father's rights, but in the circuit court...
If it were void ab initio, couldn't he collaterally attack it in this proceeding?
I think abstractly, Your Honor, that's an interesting question, and maybe yes, but not on this record. There's no record by which we could do it besides
well,
this
that,
court
I mean,
doesn't engage in fact-finding.
I think that's really what this comes down to. But, I mean, Judge Russell's raised some interesting interesting hypotheticals that I think may have to be addressed at some point in the future, if not in this case. But working backwards, I understand your argument, but I think it's kind of a backwards argument because We have this adoption order that's been entered, which could not have been properly entered until the parental rights have been terminated or they've been voluntarily surrendered. And then we have the termination of parental rights, and which requires notice to the parent whose rights are being terminated. We don't have a record, but the allegation is that that was not done. So, you know, from the standpoint of your initial premise that that final order can't be touched, while it's clear that that's what the statute says, there are clearly recognized legal principles under which it could be attacked collaterally as being void for either constitutional or other statutory reason because of well, I guess it would always be constitutional for failure to provide fundamental due process.
Correct. And in the McCallum case and in the FE versus GFM case, what the putative fathers did, actually those were actual birth fathers in those cases, what they did was they filed a petition to vacate or set aside the adoption. So if the appellant can make out a case, can plead extrinsic fraud or whatever the appellant needs to do to get past that six-month window, there is another avenue that the appellant can take. But the appellant did not pursue the paternity case, Your Honor. It was appealed, and it was never pursued. This, however, is not the appropriate forum to adjudicate questions of due process and notice. I think it's also important to point out that assignment of error number one deals with a specific statute, 63.212.11. This statute permits but does not require a circuit court judge to revoke an interlocutory order before the entry of a final order. And as we've argued on our brief, this statute also does not provide any relief to the appellant. So, and also the due process and the notice issues are not properly before this court. There is no fact-finding from the trial court that this court can review. There is no record by which this court can determine that the already established rights of the adoptive parents or the well-established orders from the juvenile court and the circuit court are erroneous. And so for these reasons, we believe that the court must affirm the decision below or dismiss it as moot.
Thank you, Ms. Mundy.
Thank you.
Ms. Banks?
Your Honor, I would just like to say that, as I stated in our reply brief, that we didn't find out that the final order of adoption had been entered until during the course of this appeal. And once we found that out, I immediately stated in my reply brief that we believe that the final order of adoption is void ab initio because of the egregious due process errors that took place from the outset of these proceedings. We can't overlook that, because if you overlook that, then it gives validity to all these orders, which should not have any validity at all. The code section 63.2-1250E does state that a putative father is required to have notice. It's required to have notice via either personal service or certified mail, but there are amplitude
that's
of cases.
That's certainly what the statute says.
Right.
Let me finish. But in the abstract, though, if you're the putative father, the statute says you're required to have notice. If you're the actual father, in other words, if you're the biological father, the Constitution requires that you have notice. But so in order for you to assert the constitutional right that was violated, it's not enough that you establish you're the putative father. You have to establish you're the actual father.
Okay. But if we establish that he was a putative father and did not receive the notice that he was entitled to, which is in the record, it shows that it was mailed and returned. It was undeliverable. And I have to take issue with what counsel said that, oh, it's only required that the notice be mailed. I don't believe that was the intent of the Virginia State legislation, when they said, here's an important right, and all we're going to do is say it needs to be mailed. As the Supreme Court says, notice means it needs to be mailed and it needs to be intended to get to its recipient so that we're not missing any rights that involve a child's life here.
and now that a father is going to be prevented, could possibly be prevented from challenging any aspects of that proceeding because of the failure to receive due process from the outset of the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Banks. All right, we'll come down to Greek Council and take up the last case of the